I'm Tom Morello, host of Maximum Firepower, a weekly podcast focusing on the music, the moments, and the movements that have shaped my worldview and left an indelible mark on me as an artist and activist.
Come correct with Maximum Firepower.
For you and me.
This is Tom Morello's Maximum Firepower.
I'm Tom Morello, and welcome to Maximum Firepower. I am joined this week by brother Wayne Kramer of the mighty MC5, the Motor City 5, and Chris Dose, Chris number 2 of Anti-Flag. One thing that was certainly disruptive on a number of levels was the Rock Against Bush tour in 2003. Now, this was... I don't know if you know this part of the story, but this was, the election was coming up and, you know, there was war and collusion with Wall Street and the world was headed into a dumpster. And I got a call from, I think it was like the Bruce Springsteen management. They were going on a sort of a pro John Kerry tour. They had, I think it was called Rock for Change or Voice for Change or something like that. And it was Conor Oberst was on it. I think Neil Young, I think REM was playing some. And they asked me to do something on that. I got a call at exactly the same time for a tour called the Rock Against Bush tour that was being hosted by Anti-Flag. And I don't know if you know this, Chris, but I said, these two tours should be one tour. And like, let's get me and Anti-Flag on this tour, and we'll have, you know, there'll be sort of a diversity of political perspectives, but all both rocking for change and being against Bush at the same time. It was a hard no. The band's name, Anti-Flag, was not going to fly for whatever it was they were, whatever Kerry.
Kerry. For what? I don't have no idea why. Yeah.
and so I made what for me was the easy decision was to go on this sort of the punk rock version of that. So Chris, tell me some of your memories of the, my principal memory. I have a lot of memories. Anti-Flag was headlining. I was going out as the Night Watchman. It was an acoustic political troubadour. And we got the bus. There was some money in it from like Fat Records or something like that. Yeah. They wrapped the bus. Like the bus was really beautifully done. That said, Rock Against Bush. I think it's some like ugly caricature of George W. Bush on the side. And we drove this bus all around the South, and we drove it everywhere. And we would get egged from time to time, and like tractor trailers swerving us off the road from time to time.
Yeah, they called it the Rock Against Bus Tour because people threw rocks at somebody.
Which is very, very apt. Yeah.
It also had facts and stats as to why you should consider not voting for George Bush on the side of the bus. So there was another funny bus story is that the bus company got the rap. They were like, yeah, cool. They cast the check. And then when they unfolded it and saw what it was, they refused to do it. So our bus driver bought a heat gun and he put the rap on himself under a bridge in Seattle the day of the first show.
Oh my gosh, that's fantastic.
And the bus driver also kept a tally of how many like positive honks and how many middle fingers he got.
And what was the ratio?
There were more middle fingers, so we were pretty convinced we were going to lose.
That was the unofficial straw poll. But
it's also where that amalgamation of the Rock Against Bush stuff is where I met Wayne when we went to the Iowa caucuses together and performed.
Scott Goodstein.
Who went on to do incredible stuff for Barack Obama and
he ran the digital campaign for Barack Obama and was involved in Bernie's campaign as well. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think that why it was really important to have us involved, the three of us that are on this conversation, is because it wasn't our first forte into politics. And what I found, maybe the most fatal flaw of that whole thing, was we didn't prepare people for failure. And Bush was kind of the beginning of what we're seeing now, where people are hitching their wagon to presidents so fervorously. And it really doesn't matter to you and I who the president is. And especially those that have an empathetical compass where you're trying to lift up those that are most vulnerable. They're still vulnerable regardless of if it's Biden or Trump or regardless of if it's Bush or Kerry, et cetera, et cetera. We're trying to minimize that damage with our actions, which is why we do these things and why we do get involved in a process of voting. But it's not where the activism begins or ends. It's just a a part of it. And so for a lot of bands that got involved with Rock Against Bush, whether it was on the Warped Tour or Lollapalooza or the other places that we kind of niched our way in, some of those bands were like, oh shit, we lost. We're done with politics. We're not going to be into this anymore. And that's just not really how it works for those of us that live it every day. So I think that it was real valuable that we were a part of that tour, counterintuitive to the Conor Oberst and the Sheryl Crows of the worlds that went on the big one. But I think that our main value in it was explaining to these people that came to the shows, like, yeah, it's good to vote against the war and vote against George Bush and vote against corporate welfare states. But it also is very valuable to be, you know, where you spend your money is more important than where you vote a lot of the time. And the way we lift up those that are, you know, the targets of police violence, that's the conversation we need to be having, not necessarily, I voted for Joe Biden, therefore I'm going to wear his t-shirt around and fucking put a sign, a flag from my house. Like, that's fucking ridiculous to me. Politicians are not celebrities. And if they are, they should be knocked off their pedestal.
One of the most memorable parts for that tour was, you know, this was a punk rock audience. This is an anti-flag audience. So the age, there's 15-year-olds to whatever-year-olds who are fervent fans of punk rock music. Some of these fans have heard... I've heard of a band called Rage Against the Machine. Some of them, a fewer percentage still, might be even familiar with the guitar player Tom Morello as like the shredding axe master. None of them, 0% of them, are ready for that guy to come out there with an acoustic guitar and with his rich milk chocolate baritone voice sing them some folk songs. Let me tell you that.
Yeah, you didn't have a song out. You didn't have an album out.
I didn't have an album out. I didn't have a song out. I didn't have anything out. I'm like, my name's Tom Morello. I'm like, all right, Bulls on Parade, bro. Bulls on Parade, bro. I'm like, why does he have a nylon string acoustic guitar? And I was just like, I was on such a mission. I'm like, every day I go out there and I'm going to, you know, my job is to win over this this seething throng of, you know.
Successful every time. Also, quick anecdote. The first show Tom shows up, it's in San Francisco. I remember this like it was yesterday. San Francisco, 2003. Tom walks in with his guitar, raises his hand while we're sound checking. There's a cab out front that needs paid. I don't have any money.
I totally remember that. I totally remember that. And the tour ended ingloriously as well. As I just, it's just like on a dark Pittsburgh street on a dark Pittsburgh hill. I like got my bag out of it was like rolling up there, and I looked over my shoulder and said to you guys, and he was never seen again.
Yeah, the bus driver closes the door as Tom says, and he was never see it again. And we just drove off and I was like, I really hope we see him again. That was brilliant.
That's super funny. So, all right. So I want to sort of from the, if you could each just relay, because sometimes people are like, what's the point? Like, what's the point? And I know that I'm running into people every day at the pre-pandemic at the grocery store where people say the music was impactful to them. It made them become a public defender. It made them became a brick-throwing anarchist. It opened their mind to look at it, to consider anti-racism as something they might engage with. But I'd like to talk about like sort of specific concrete victories that you have been involved in as someone involved in a protest band. Wayne.
We formed a political party. It was about 50% in jest because we weren't all that serious, but the Black Panther Party, Huey Newton said there needed to be a white group in the white community that does parallel but separate work. And we said, that's us. And, you know, we had weapons and we embraced a militant stance. And someone bombed the CIA office in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I didn't set a bomb. I don't know any bombers. The FBI indicted and arrested three of our members, John Sinclair, White Panther Minister of Defense, Pun Plamondon, and a third man, Jack Forrest. And they said they had phone conversations of them talking about dynamite. When we got to federal court in Detroit, we asked to see the warrants for the wiretaps to tap our phones. They said, we don't have to show you the warrants. It's the national security. We're not going to do it. So Judge Damon Keith threw the case out. The U.S. Justice Department appealed the case to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati, who sided with us again that the government had to have a warrant to tap our phones. Again, the Justice Department, the Mitchell Justice Department, appealed, and we went to the United States Supreme Court. And our lawyer, the great Arthur Kanoy, the labor lawyer, argued in that if a sitting president could, by decree, order the wiretaps of citizens, who knows, he might wiretap his political rivals, never realizing that that exact thing was happening right up the street at the Watergate headquarters of the Democratic Party. Kanoy made a compelling argument to the justices, and we all sat back and waited for the decision. On the Monday, the decision would come down. Everyone kind of felt like the White Panthers were going to win this, you know, that it was clearly violated the Sixth Amendment. On the Sunday night before the Monday, the plumbers were caught taking the bugs out of the Watergate Democratic headquarters, because on Monday, they would be illegal. So this rock band from Detroit and a bunch of crazed poets brought down Richard Nixon. I put a Fender Stratocaster up his ass.
That's a great story. I didn't know that, Wayne. That's great.
Yeah. And now you're going to ask me to follow that? I mean, that's incredible. And, you know, looking at this conversation generationally, a lot of anti-flags activism has occurred in a post-Patriot Act world. Those wiretaps, all of that stuff is completely legal now on the basis of conspiracy. Yeah. And so I think that, you know, like, again, going back to my family, you know, my cousin is in jail for cocaine right now on conspiracy charges through the Patriot Act because they tapped all their phones together. And it's incredible that a lot of people don't recognize that when they pass these things in the interest of national security, I'm using air quotes here for the listeners at home, it has turned into domestic policy. And I think that in line with the Patriot Act, the greatest accomplishment of, or one of the greater accomplishments of anti-flag is that there was a little known provision in the No Child Left Behind Act that gave military recruiters access to high school students' records. And when we went to high school, there was a little card you got and you filled that out if you wanted the military to have your information. This automatically did it and you had to opt out from giving the military your information. Hmm. So we partnered with Jim McDermott, who was a congressman from Seattle. And that's we challenged that provision and were able to get it overturned with a lot of cool activism. He had a photo of anti-flag in the Capitol and he was like, they look like weirdos, but they have a good thing. You
know? Right on.
Yeah. So, I mean, much less compelling than your story, Wayne, but,
but it's equally as important.
Equally as important. I think the thing in all these stories is the recognition that courage is contagious, you know, and that merely sort of standing up for the thing in and of itself has a great value, but sometimes there are concrete wins. And, you know, I've been fortunate to be a part of a number of them. The one that I'll highlight is the Immokalee workers in Florida. They're the people like that pick the tomatoes and the lettuce for Burger King's and McDonald's and whatnot. And they had a very sort of modest, they were organizing around like getting like sort of one more cent an hour or something like that. And we're, of course, the growers said, absolutely not. That would, you know, we'll never do it. And, you know, in playing a number of shows on their behalf in a number of different states, I was in no way responsible for that victory. But the idea of helping, letting those people who are on the front lines know that they're not alone, letting them know that people are paying attention, helping to steal the backbone of people who are physically on the picket lines. You know, many of them had never heard of any of the bands that I was in. But like, here's a guy from Los Angeles who's come here to be here today because he cares that we make another cent an hour, you know, it does help put wind in the sails. And we won. And they got everything they wanted. And they won. It was through their perseverance and their fight. But being able to, one, shed a little bit of a light on it with the people who listen to my music, but also of being shoulder to shoulder with people who are working on a daily basis, who do not have podcasts and who do not have access to recording studios and things like that is in and of itself a worthwhile endeavor. I'm Tom Morello. This is Tom Morello's Maximum Firepower. We're talking with Brother Wayne Kramer, the MC5, and Chris Dose of Anti-Flag. I want to talk for a little bit about Jail Guitar Doors. Wayne, tell us what Jail Guitar Doors is and how The Clash wrote a song about you.
Well, in the 1970s, after the MC5 imploded, I lost my way and fell in with a crew of unsavory characters. And thought I was a gangster, thought I was going to sling drugs and I was going to make a lot of money. And of course, you know, as a gangster, I'm a total failure and I'm not a killer and I'm not a hustler and I'm not tough. And the judge didn't see it that way. And so he gave me a 4-year prison term. While I was locked up, this new music emerged, punk rock. And this band in England wrote a song called Jail Guitar Doors that chronicled my misadventures with the police and a couple other fellow musicians, Peter Green and Keith Richards. And I thought at the time, you know, when I got out of prison, everyone said, well, you know, the Clash wrote this song about you. I thought it was terrific. You know, it was a great show of solidarity from some brother musicians that I didn't even know and didn't think much more of it. And then after I was released from prison, I watched for 30 years as more and more people just like me went to prison for longer sentences under worse conditions than I did. And finally, the activists in me just got pissed off enough that I had to do something. You know, the treatment for my own apathy and my own cynicism is taking ethical action. So what could I do? Well, music was important to me when I was in prison. And I think it was important to my fellow prisoners. Let me call up all my musician friends and get them to come with me and we'll do some concerts in prisons. Tom Morello's one of the guys I took with me on the very first Jail Guitar Doors intervention, along with the great activist and troubadour, Billy Bragg. Billy had Jail Guitar Doors written on his guitar. I said, what's up with that? He told me he had launched an initiative in Britain to honor Joe Strummer's life's work and call it Jail Guitar Doors and provide instruments to prisoners to use as tools for rehabilitation. The more we talked about it, I decided this was exactly what I was looking for. And on that same day, 11 years ago now, we launched Jail Guitar Doors USA. What we do is simple.
We played in Sing Sing prison. Don't sort of gloss over the gig.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you.
Don't gloss over the gig where we played Thin Lizzy's Jailbreak in Sing Sing prison in front of a room of hardened criminals. That was quite an afternoon, Wayne. I got to tell you.
And Tom killed it. They stood up and cheered when Tom played.
Well, I'll say what they did. Like I had known Wayne for a while, and you know he was always there whenever asked to do some sort of show. But I had never seen Wayne in this particular context. We're playing the show, and it's going. It's weird playing in Sing Sing prison, which is. Like an old draconian kind of jail. It's not one of those sort of super maxi ones. It's a very like sort of old castle.
It's medieval.
Medieval. And so, you know, we're playing the show and then Wayne gets on the mic and addresses the prisoners who are playing there. And it was a different person than I had ever been around before. Like Wayne is commanding this room, like Wayne, who has been in a facility just like this one. You know, there was a slight shift in sort of in vernacular and in focus, and he just had everyone in the room just wrapped. And I was like, Wayne Kramer is a bad motherfucker, man. He's a great guitar player. He's in the MC5. That's all fantastic. I'm like, but this guy, like, what is happening? You know, and then in the aftermath of that day, I believe was when the spark for Jail Guitar Doors began, correct?
Yeah. What we do is we find people that work in corrections that are willing to use music as a tool for rehabilitation or abilitation in most cases. And we provide them with instruments. And we also have developed a curriculum and a syllabus to run songwriting workshops in prisons, which are really therapeutic in that they, in the first place, we do not recognize gang affiliations, neighborhood affiliations, race, class, sexual orientation. Prison politics all stay out on the yard in our workshops. In our workshops, everyone in this room are artists, and we can talk about anybody and anything, but we have to treat each other with dignity and respect. The men and women love the program. They live from week to week to get back in that room and work on music and just be regular guys, just be human beings, which is what they are. They're natural, normal people, just like all of us. And today, our instruments and programs are in about 170 American prisons. And today, we're most excited about our CAPO Youth Center, the all-one center. We've come to the conclusion that the important part of the job, working with adults, is important. But if we can interrupt, if we can disrupt the cradle-to-prison pipeline, then we're all going to come out ahead. So we started working with young people a couple years ago in the L.A. County Probation Department, working in the youth camps. It's funny, peculiar, not funny. They call them camps. What they are is prisons for children. And we would work with them using the same songwriting programs. We'd have to shift the style from playing guitars to turntables and microphones, because all the kids are, they're down with rap. You know, we're kind of, old with our white guys with our guitars, but they didn't hold it against us. And we were able to accommodate them.
Talk about a calling. You know what I mean? Like, it really felt, it really was a calling. You could see you were sort of like inhabited by the Holy Spirit of this new mission, to do this thing. And it was pretty amazing.
To be able to take the principle of being of service to my fellows. I mean, who are my fellows? They're the 2.3 million guys doing time in this country. You know, I am those guys. They're me. You know, when I was talking to those guys at Sing Sing, like, those are the only times I feel like people really understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah, they understood. Let me tell you, they understood. Yeah. That was crystal clear.
Well, I think that, you know, when you talk about punk rock, there are so many parallels to what's happening in music creation via the computer, via our phones, where our resources are limited, but these kids or whoever are creating out of nothing. And that is the genesis of punk rock So whether it's you find your drum kit in the dumpster or your drum kit's now on your fucking phone, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, that's what I want to ask is sort of like a part. And Chris, you can start like, what is your advice to those who are starting a band or aspiring to be a music creator that have activist inclinations in this year?
Well, I mean, it's just like, you know, the lessons are there from you guys. Let your activism and your empathy and your ethics guide you, and the art that you create will reflect that. So whether you're looking at your own world or your family or where you work or where you go to school, and there's something that you want to influence or change, then you just use your vocation to do that. I mean, it's that simple. You know, you could put, anyone in the world can put a song on the internet right now and it could be heard by millions of people.
Yeah.
You don't need the infrastructures of record labels or tour buses or whatever. You know, we have instantaneous access to the world. And the last thing I want to say to Wayne is, don't sell your guitar too short in those studio sessions, because we had a recent session with some hip hop artists and I was playing a riff and someone recorded it and they're sending files to each other through the air and it comes back. It doesn't sound like the guitar that I played, but you're in there somewhere.
The guitar still has a place in it all. Sure. Of course.
Yeah.
We're not going quietly.
Into that talk. No, we are not. No, we are not. I still have a feeling that the best guitars have yet to be played. So I'd like to thank you both. Thank you very much, Wayne Kramer. Thank you very much, Chris, for being on Tom Morello's Maximum Firepower. The world isn't going to change itself. That's up to you. So until next time, take it easy, but take it.
Let foes of justice tremble.
This has been Tom Morello's Maximum Firepower.
Hear this episode again
or listen to past shows right now
on the SiriusXM app.
Search Maximum Firepower.